Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, director Cindy Goldfield talks about Sleeping Cutie, a fractured fairy tale musical currently playing at Thick House in San Francisco. Conductor Nicole Paimont talks about Opera Parallèle's melding of Francis Poulenc and Kurt Weill for Mahagoni Songspiel with Les Mamelles de Tiresias. Sean Uehara talks up the San Francisco International Film Festival. And actors Beth Wilmert and Michael Ray Wisely talk about their roles in The Letters, a suspenseful psychological thriller at the Aurora. And critic Peter Robinson will be stopping by with a tribute to Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I'll try to get my words together for Open Air this week. Stay with us. San Francisco International Film Festival gets underway tonight with a star-studded feature film and party. The film is The Two Faces of January by Hossein Amini and stars Viggo Mortensen and Kirsten Dunst. The party's in the Mission afterwards. And here to talk about all 168 films in 12 minutes is Sean Uehara, one of the programmers for the festival. Well, Sean, in actuality, we're going to focus a little bit better on that. But welcome back to KALW.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, and thanks for that regal introduction.
Well, you deserve it after all the work you put in for this. Boy, it's hard to believe it's already been a year since the last festival. You guys must have been working on this year's festival from the day that last year's ended, given the number of films that are involved.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it feels like that, but we also have a full fall season at the Film Society. So right after this festival, the San Francisco International, we have a bunch of other fall season festivals that happen later. So we do things year-round.
Instead of doing a highlight of all 168 films, we're going to focus a little bit, just for a few minutes, on things that are happening live and on stage, one of which is Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. Tell me about this event that's happening at the Castro Theater this coming Tuesday.
Yeah, so our live and on stage section of the film festival incorporates live elements with projected imagery, and Tao Nguyen is the leader of the band Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. She is going to play live with a number of her songs. Her last album, We the Common, came out, and it was really hugely acclaimed critically. And she lives locally, and she just got off of a tour with Radiolab for the NPR listeners out there. And she's just a really fascinating and amazing musician.
Neat. Radiolab, Tuesdays at 10 p.m. here on KALW. Maybe we'll hear her segment on one of the upcoming shows. So we actually do have a couple of tickets to offer for that Tuesday, April 29th performance of Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. And we'll get the phones ringing right now at 415-841-4134. Two tickets are available for Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, part of the San Francisco International Film Festival, which gets underway tonight. Great film lined up for the opening. Boy, it should be something.
Yeah, it's based on a Patricia Highsmith novel, and for people who are into her work, you know, with the talented Mr. Ripley and other types of novels that are about people who are not exactly what they seem, this will really fit in with their expectations.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that's coming up on the second week of the festival, on May 6th, also at the Castro Theater, is Stephen Merritt with The Unknown, another live event that's happening. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, with Tao Nguyen and Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, they're going to play with a number of shorts, including a Charlie Chaplin short, some experimental work, some animation, plus Tao makes her own short movies, and she made one especially for this night, and it'll be really fun. And Stephen Merritt will also be amazing, but he's going to focus on just one feature-length film, The Unknown. It's a film directed by Todd Browning, who some of your listeners may know. He's the director of Freaks. And It stars Lon Chaney and Joan Crawford, and it's about a circus performer who is supposedly armless, but there's a lot of twists, and I guess I say supposedly as you can guess as to why that is. And it's a very strange film. And Stephen Merritt is going to create a brand new score for the movie. He's also going to play with a short film by a filmmaker named Guy Madden. He's going to be joined with Daniel Handler, who's also known as Lemony Snicket. He sometimes plays with Merritt. Merritt's the leader of a band called Magnetic Fields, and he has another band called The Sixes, which is the hardest word to say in English, Sixes. And he plays with Daniel Handler in that band. And they're going to get the audience to participate with this short film by Guy Madden. It's called Sissy Boy Slap Party. So who knows what's going to happen there.
All right. Well, we've got two tickets for that event as well. Stephen Merritt with The Unknown at Tuesday, May 6th at the Castro Theater, 415-841-4134 if you're interested in the pass to that concert. A lot is going on, Sean. Tell us about the screening process for getting films involved into the festival.
Yeah. Well, every way that you can imagine that we would get a film has probably happened. I work with a number of other programmers, and a lot of people go to festivals. We have consultants around the world who let us know about things. We read the trades, you know, like Variety and Hollywood Reporter and things like that. And then we get films that are just submitted to us blind. And I'd say that we show a few films through that process. And, you know, just like I say, we just hear about things and we watch as many movies as we can and try to whittle it down.
Mm-hmm. Part of the festival is several awards are offered and quite a bit of prize money is offered as well. I think over $40,000 go to various festivals. Filmmakers as a part of the awards process. Could you share a little bit about some of the more significant awards that are happening?
Yeah, we have a New Directors Award. That's for a first-time feature-length film director working in fiction. We have a Documentary Award that's for the best documentary, of course, at the festival. We have Audience Awards, and we have a number of Shorts Awards. So there are a few competitions that are going on during the screenings, and there are juries that sit live in the audience. And on Wednesday, May 7th, trying to remember the exact date, we have what's called our Golden Gate Awards Ceremony, and that's where all of the awards are bestowed.
Mm-hmm. And locally represented directors?
Oh, we have a ton. We have a film called The Overnighters. It's a documentary by Jesse Moss. It's about migrant workers, migrant oil workers, and there's a lot of twists. My colleague at the Film Society, Noah Cowan, likes to say that the twists in this documentary are worthy of The Good Wife. We have a film called The Last Season, by local filmmaker Sarah Dosa. And she's made a film that's about mushroom hunting and post-traumatic stress. Even though it's a documentary, I think that you could say, after watching it legitimately, that it's novelistic. We have a film called Hellion by Kat Candler, which is a wonderful film about young boys trying to deal with loss. We have Ping Pong Summer, which is a throwback to the 80s. It's by a director named Michael Tully. It really feels like a throwback to things like The Karate Kid and films like that.
Fantastic. Well, over 168 films, 56 countries represented, over 40 languages. Four world premieres also involved in this festival. 45 women directors, which I think is a biggest number, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I know that we do look out for that, and it's something that we're really sensitized to, is just the general makeup and mix of the directors and also the films in the country that they represent overall. I don't know the exact numbers from year to year, but it feels about the same. I mean, it feels maybe a few more women directors than last year, but it feels great in terms of the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a San Francisco institution for over 50. This is the 57th year this has been going on. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Again, all the ticket giveaways have been taken, so please no more calls. But there's lots of information at the festival website. Best way to learn about the films and to get tickets for some of these amazing events that are going on, festival.sf.com. sffs.org, festival.sffs.org, including information about tonight's opening night and opening night film and party.
Yeah.
We've got to let you go because you've got to start prepping for that party, I believe.
Yeah, I have to go put my makeup on and get my hair cut.
All right, there you go. Sean Uehara, thanks for coming in. And maybe next year we'll spend a little bit more time in advance of the festival to get some word out and some directors on board here.
Anything you say, I hope people come out, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming by. Still to come on Open Air, we'll be talking with Nicole Paimon about the melding of Francis Poulenc and Kurt Weill. Plus, Cindy Goldfield's going to be talking about Sleeping Cutie, a fractured fairy tale musical, which is currently at Thick House in San Francisco. Actors Beth Wilmert and Michael Ray Wisely talk about their roles in The Letters at the Aurora. Lots more to come here on KALW, including Peter Robinson with a tribute to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, as well as some information about some local cabaret. Stay with us. Well, for 4 weeks only at Thick House here in San Francisco on 18th Street is Sleeping Cutie, which is billed as a fractured fairy tale musical with music by Doug Katsaros and lyrics by Diane Sampson. It's directed by Cindy Goldfield, who joins me in studio here on Open Air to talk about Sleeping Cutie the musical. Cindy is an award-winning director, actor, choreographer, and cabaret artist who for more than 20 years is making a living here in the Bay Area as a theater professional. Cindy, it's such a pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you.
Back to Open Air, I believe.
Yeah, well, thank you.
You were here with Scrumbly Codewin.
I was a while ago. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So, fractured fairy tale. What comes to mind to me is Jay Ward and those fractured fairy tales from the
Rocky and Bullwinkle
days. Is that part of the inspiration for this?
I think it's definitely part of the inspiration for the title. Just that idea that it's not a straight-ahead fairy tale. It's not a musical fairy tale as you'd expect. There are turns and twists that are different than the normal path, say.
Okay.
But it has nothing to do with Rocky and Bullwinkle.
All right, good. Let's get that out of the way. So how is Sleeping Cutie a fairy tale?
Well, it's a fairy tale in that magical things happen to ostensibly real people. The story has to do with a...
pulled from recent headlines, let's
say. Yes, ripped from the headlines, a Ponzi-esque scheming guy who ends up in jail and his daughter who is left to pick up the pieces of her life and try and figure out how to grow up really fast in a short amount of time and fulfill her big dream, which is to become a drummer in an indie rock band.
All right. And so who is the sleeping cutie in this show?
The sleeping cutie is our daughter, okay. Lucy. And her father is convinced that she's a narcoleptic, but really it's because she sneaks out of the house to go listen to music all night and then falls asleep during the day in the middle of conversations.
Now, on your website, you refer to yourself as an instigator, not just a director. Can you explain what you're instigating in this?
Well, in general... I tend to wear a lot of hats. On this particular production, I'm the director and the choreographer, but I'm also a line producer and I'm building props and costumes. I just am a person that I grew up in small town community theater and have always been insistent that I was going to make a living in this business. And sometimes that means doing a lot of other things. And I tend to just stir up trouble. If there's not enough work going on, then I'm going to make something happen.
So how many are involved in the cast for this show?
There's seven in the cast. There's the father and his daughter. There's a mysterious woman, which we don't know why she's involved. There's their housekeeper, Mary. There's a young man that Lucy is romantically involved in. with, I should say. And then there's two utility men that play a million different characters. And they're part of my favorite section of the show because they just get to do all sorts of crazy things. They become, you know, suitors. They become rock band guys. They become Carl Ponzi and Bernie Madoff. They just get to do all sorts of things.
So it sounds like people are going to have fun looking at this, too.
Yeah, it's a pretty fun show.
Yeah.
So it's not a heavy show.
Can you describe the music of Doug Katsouros? What kind of genre is he? Is Broadway-like? Or?
Doug definitely runs the gamut between, you know, sort of contemporary rock scores. But he's also the guy that did the jingle by Menon. Do you remember that?
By Menon.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
That's Doug Katsouros.
Yeah.
There you go. Everyone knows Doug Katsouros.
I'd like that little royalty to come my way.
Yeah, no kidding, huh?
So now he's turned his pen to full musicals.
Yeah, he's an orchestrator and a...
instigator as well.
Yes, probably. He would probably self-identify as an instigator as well. He works in New York. He lives in New Jersey. And so a lot of this score was done... via Skype and email and things like that. He did come out here for a week at the beginning of our rehearsal process, and he was out last year. There was a reading of a different version of the script, and he came out and worked with the cast on that. This incarnation of the script is pretty much brand new. We had a reading in February, and then just got in there and dug it apart and
retooled it.
And Diane Sampson, the playwright, is a lovely woman who's not only talented but a very flexible and collaborative artist. And she, with the advice and help and suggestions from various cast members and myself, just retooled the whole thing and made the story really move right along. It's a brisk, logical script now.
Nice.
Yeah.
So the website also has this song called What This Isn't, which names about every other Disney musical cliche that it isn't. So what is the music going to be like?
Well, it's definitely a mix. There's some straight-ahead musical theater sounds. There is a rock band that plays on stage, and they have sort of... oh, I'd say sort of a hard driving. It's an indie rock sound, but it's definitely on the rockier end of things. There's some lovely ballads. There's a soft shoe number. There's pretty much a variety of things. There's some lovely ballads and also some hummable melodies.
And how are these being accompanied?
We have our music director, David Aaron Brown, has put together a little combo of keyboards, bass, and drums. The keyboards double as lots of different instruments, but it's only three musicians up there.
And what do we see on stage?
You see the band behind a scrim, and then on stage, all of the locations are represented just by furniture. So there's the father in his jail cell, and there's the mysterious woman who is in a rehab center, and they stay on stage the whole time. They're corresponding via email. And then the center of the stage becomes various different locations, including their house and a rock club in the Lower East Side, and his dreamscape. And then there's this magical world that I call Meta Land, which is, nobody will get that, but we call it Meta Land.
It's Sleeping Cutie the Musical. That's the website, sleepingcutiemusical.org, if you want to learn more about this fractured fairy tale music. Musical, music by Doug Katsouros with lyrics by Diane Sampson. Cindy Goldfield is an actor, director, and instigator of this very special event at Thick House. It runs through May 11th. Cindy, thanks for taking a little bit of time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, more information about Sleeping Cutie at sleepingcutiemusical.org. Opera on the docket still this hour of Open Air with Nicole Pamont and the opera parallel production of music of Francis Poulenc and Kurt Weill. Plus Peter Robinson will stop by with some cabaret and a remembrance of a wonderful poet. But more theater next here on Open Air. The Aurora Theater Company presents its first fully staged production in the company's second stage performance space, Harry's Upstage. Award-winning Bay Area auteur Mark Jackson returns to the company to direct the Bay Area premiere of John Lowell's suspenseful psychological thriller, The Letters. Featuring Beth Wilmert and Michael Ray Wisely, the play runs through June 1st. Both Beth and Michael Ray are longtime West Coast acting veterans who have been featured in other Aurora Theater productions, Beth most recently in The Eccentricities of a Nightingale, and Michael Ray in The Arsonists. And it's a pleasure to welcome them to our studios for Open Air.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot,
nice
David.
To be here.
Of course.
Great to
see you.
So The Letters is not necessarily on everyone's top shelf of contemporary plays to know and read, so maybe you could offer us a Cliff Notes version of what's going to happen in The Letters.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that because we don't want to give away too much of it.
Sort of a mystery.
Yeah, it's a mystery. It's a
play. All right. Thank you for being with us today. We'll see it.
I mean, you were saying something about it earlier. I wonder how we can talk about it without
giving too
without
much
giving
away.
It too
it's
much
more,
away.
Yeah, about the dynamics between us. It's kind of a cat and mouse.
Well, let's talk about the setting.
Yeah, the setting, 1930s, Soviet Union, a boss employee situation.
Yeah, named as the director. My character is named the director, and he's the director of a ministry, of an organization. They never really say what it is, but over the course of the play, you learn what it is. And you play?
I play Anna Borsovna, and I work in the ministry, and I'm an editor. And it seems to be, I seem to be censoring editing some documents.
Right.
Yeah. Then I've been called into the office, to the big boss's office for the first time, and I'm not quite sure what's up. And this kind of
cat and mouse game.
Cat and mouse.
Ensues. Right.
Well, let's have a little taste of the play, maybe. Then we won't be giving too much away, but let's get a little scene play
sure.
of part of The Letters by John Lowell.
Great. And in this scene, I'm talking to Anna Borsovna about what's happening around the ministry. I'm trying to fill her in on some things, and I'm asking her some questions. All right, then. Things are happening around the ministry. What does that mean? I'm speaking of changes. Changes of the most fundamental sort. And before I implement those changes, I need information of the kind only you can provide.
I'm happy to tell you whatever I know.
There's an irresistible invitation. So, to begin, let's start with your time here.
You mean my years in the ministry?
Precisely. Give me an impromptu work autobiography.
As you wish, Director, but how does that pertain to current operations?
Proceed.
Well, in brief, I was brought to the ministry...
Excuse me. I didn't ask you to be brief.
I arrived at the ministry in 1922. I was brought in by Director Lukovsky.
Ah, Lukovsky! Whatever else is said about him, he displayed a rare gift for organization. His removal must have been quite a shock to you people, in the trenches, as you put it.
It was terrible, Director, and I never knew what happened.
No. Is that right?
I think that's good.
I think that's probably all you need to hear.
All right. That's an excerpt from The Letters by John Lowell. We heard the entire cast of The Letters performing that scene. That cast is Beth Wilmert, who is playing the role you have again.
Anna Borsovna, who works in the ministry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And Michael Ray Wisely playing the director. Gosh, this seems like it was picture perfect for what's happening in the news right now. Soviet era Russia setting of a play.
It's really quite dynamic in that way. And that, I mentioned that the first day of rehearsal. I was like, it seems like every time you pick a show these days, as long as it has some, some pretty, I guess, universal themes, you can fit it into whatever. But this really, with the things that are happening in the Crimea and actually several of the themes, and I won't elaborate on them, and please come see it and find out, but several of the themes that are going on in Russia right now are play out in this play.
So did contemporary events help inform your growth process learning the roles?
I was just asked about that yesterday. Mm. Yeah, I guess. What's really interesting is that Mark Jackson, who is our director, who I have so much respect for, and he is really interested in 20th century Russian politics and life. And he started being interested in Meyerhold.
Yes, right? That's right, a theater and, director.
And so, and Meyerhold was about acting, but it was also about some of the themes that are in this play. And I think that history is being informed by him, but it's also, I don't think you can not be affected by what's happening, you know, now in Russia, which is very interesting because Russia really isn't that much different from other countries. They're just a little more open about their brutality, you know, where we're a little more underhanded with ours.
Our brutality is discovered 10 years after
That's
it happens.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, yeah. I mean, you know, it's just two different ways. And I think it speaks to their culture and what they come out of. It's not really, you know, is every country that much different from the others? No, there's just different ways of that you've grown up.
Mm-hmm. You know. Have either of you worked with the director Mark Jackson before?
I have, but not near as much as Beth has.
He's my longtime partner as of 25 years.
Oh, fantastic.
So we've done a lot of things together.
Has it really been 25 years with you
Yeah,
guys?
Maybe 24.
Not all play acting then.
What's that?
Not all acting, I hope.
No. But we've done quite a few shows
David.
Together, but I'm not in everything, you know.
Right. And by the way, that was one of the things that whenever they asked me to do it, I had been I'd admired Beth for quite a while, and especially last year she did a play called Eccentricities of
Two seasons ago.
Tennessee Williams play, and I just found her so vulnerable and so interesting on stage, and I'd always wanted to work with Mark Jackson since he had been doing things around the Bay Area. Very interesting work, very different work, by the way. He does different work than a lot of people, and I found that I was able to do both of them, and I just worked with Mark on The Arsonist last season, mm-hmm. and so I was like, oh, wait, absolutely, sign me up, let's go.
Has kind of a similar energy to it, I think, The Arsonists and The Letters.
It
or
does.
Something.
Right.
It has a
Pinter-esque, it's very tense.
It's very tense and taut. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Michael Ray and I have known each other. I've known you longer than I've known Mark, actually.
I know. We met, but we haven't really
acted together.
Yeah, acted together, but we met 26 years ago, probably.
Something like that,
when
yeah.
she was in college, you were at a junior college in Las Positas, probably your first go-around in college, and I was working at a children's theater in the same town, and I was helping a friend of mine at the college.
So it's nice to finally act.
Right,
Why don't you tell us what we will see on stage, but maybe first set the setting for us, as this is a fairly new space for Aurora to be presenting in.
Yeah, it's the first time. It's called Harry's Upstage, right? It's a 49-seat house. Is that correct?
49 seats, which is crazy. I mean, I don't think I've ever worked in a 49-seat house.
Small.
Before.
And right. It's kind of fun. They've been building the set and building the theater simultaneously.
don't know which is which.
So last night we had our very first audience. And
that was tense.
And it feels tense and taut. But it feels intimate. It feels nice. It feels warm. I like the space. I think I'm excited for the patrons of Aurora to get to go check out this new space. And I think the setting and this 1930s office setting looks really nice in this upstairs area.
Right. And just like everything at the Aurora, it's done really well. I mean, they created the space. They put a lot of thought into it. And that was one of the, you know, not only was the new space, which is also called the Desha Wing, was it also to be used for rehearsal, but they had decided whenever they built it that it might be a good second space.
That's Michael Ray Wisely. He and Beth Hurley are starring in The Letters, which is by John Lowell, at the Aurora Theater through June 1st.
According already extended.
To right, that's what happens when you only have 50 seats. And quite frankly, I think the patrons are just as excited about this new space as well. So they had no trouble selling very quickly. So
fantastic.
If you want to come see it, I urge you to go ahead and get tickets without even knowing what you're going to.
AuroraTheater.org for The Letters. So what's happening for either of you after The Letters closes in June?
Well, David, that is such not an okay question to ask an actor.
It depends on if you have work or not.
Right.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, true enough.
I know.
I guess you just answered that, Michael.
You are.
Yeah, maybe you should let me answer
now. No, hold on. I have... You know what? You go ahead.
Shotgun Players a lot, too. Both of those are in Berkeley, Aurora Theater and Shotgun Players. And I have a show there coming up. But I work with them regularly as well.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. And you also directed a show.
And I directed a show at the Shotgun Players, too.
Which she auditioned me for but didn't cast me in, which was very...
You had a great audition, Michael.
Save that energy for the tension in the story.
Yes.
Right.
I have the great fortune of going on to a play in the fall. It's called Ideation. It was done at San Francisco Playhouse. It was written by a local playwright who I love. His name is Aaron Loeb, and he won the Glickman Award for that play this year, which is an award for the best play in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And so I get to go do that again at San Francisco Playhouse. And it was a huge hit earlier or at the last part of last year.
All the more reason to have you both on again soon for Open Air.
Thank you.
Michael Ray Wisely, Beth Hurley, thanks so much for taking some time to talk about The Letters currently at the Aurora Theater. Tickets and information at auroratheater.org. Yet another name mangle. It's Beth Wilmert. Beth Wilmert is part of this Aurora Theater, The Letters production. The tongue-tied David LaTulipe continuing with Open Air here on KLW. A touch of the music of Francis Poulenc to start things off with a discussion with Nicole Paimon, who's coming back to the KALW airwaves. Such a pleasure to welcome her. She and Brian Stauffenbiel are two of the driving forces between Opera Parallel and their current production, Mahogany Songspiel, with Les Mamelles de Tiresias, playing at the Yerba Buena Center this weekend. She wielding the baton, and he is concept designer and stage director. Nicole, welcome back to KALW.
Thank you.
Your creative work with Opera Parallel has resulted in productions ranging from Alban Berg and Leonard Bernstein to Philip Glass, Peter Maxwell Davies, as well as John Harbison, among many others. Just tremendously interesting productions. You're also artistic director of the Blueprint Project, a new music concert series sponsored by the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, where you hold the Jean and Josette Delage Distinguished New Music Chair. A busy time for you, especially with this production.
It is, yes.
So we have Francis Poulenc's Les Mamelles from 1947 on a libretto of Guillaume Apollinaire, and Kurt Weill's Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany, parts of that from 1930 on a text of Bertolt Brecht. Now, either one of which would make for an entirely entertaining evening of entertaining opera and cabaret, for that matter. But who thought of combining the works?
Well, the idea began by the fact that we really wanted to perform Les Mamelles de Tiresias by Poulenc. This is a piece that we feel is a masterwork of the early 20th century, and Opéra Parallèle tries to at times go back and reflect on great works that are not done very much, and it's an opera that has not been done here very much at all, and it's also a comic opera, which Opéra Parallèle doesn't often do. We tend to go to the darker, more dark sides, and we wanted to have something lighter, and especially to balance our season with what's coming up in June. And so that was the point of departure, and looking at trying to find the Mamelles is about 50 minutes long, so we wanted to incorporate another opera with it, and we started to think of what piece and how, and we thought that Kurt Weill, though it's very different background, have similar aesthetic. They just present them in a very different color, but they have shared aesthetic. And also the fact that Kurt Weill's Mahogany Songspiel is not a true opera. It's more of it's a study for what will become the rise and fall of Mahogany later on in his composition career. It would be a great opening, or like an overture to the Mamelles. And what we were trying to investigate is actually how you can combine two works to create one larger work. And we felt that these two pieces together would give us that opportunity. And that idea came from the concept designer, from Brian Stauffenbiel.
And the creation of these works, initially their inspiration are in a way similar. Listening audiences may be more familiar with the music and work of Bertolt Brecht and pre-World War II Germany. But for those not so familiar with this era, what can you offer us a Reader's Digest version of what was going on in Weill's life and the creation of his work?
Yes, well, there was, you know, they were very much into the realistic mode of how art needed to serve the community, the society, basically, and to really incorporate in art a way to connect with the what they call the normal people, the people that would be not necessarily the elite, and they were developing an art form that would serve a community. And I think that was very important, and that's why Kurt Weill went and started to use a lot of element of jazz in his music, a lot of element that came from the Berlin cabaret, a lot of these things that where people would go, and he would incorporate that in his language, in our artistic language, to basically expand and see how music can serve a community. And in that same way, actually, Poulenc did the same thing in a very different way. It wasn't so politically involved, but he was also interested in finding a way to write music that would be for the normal people, that would be more, less, they use that expression of less of the idea of you had to put your head between your hands to understand it, that it would be more, it would be uplifting, and that it would bring something to society that was not being developed at the time.
Talk to us a little bit about the inspiring work that led to the music, the Guillaume Apollinaire's Les Mamelles de Tiresias. What is, for those that aren't familiar with this fascinating story?
Yeah. Well, it's a play that was written in 1903, so a lot, 40 years, over 40 years before Poulenc wrote the opera. And it was the play that actually used for the first time the term surrealism. So, and Apollinaire used that in his preface to the opera, to his play. And he... basically, what's really interesting about this play, this surreal play, is the fact that it concerns the idea of basically women's liberation, of a woman wanting to basically remove her breasts, remove her femininity, so that she could enter the man of being the world of men and become, you know, basically have positions in the world other than just making babies at home. And that's really interesting that in 1903 in France we were already dealing with that. And what's interesting is also that in the story, then her husband says, well, if my wife is not making babies anymore, I guess I'm going to find a way to make babies. And he proceeds in creating a way to make babies, and he makes 40,049 babies in one day. And what's interesting is that it's a surreal plot, obviously, but it's not so surreal anymore. Women now have access to positions that in 1903 they didn't. And men now, if they really want to be parent and have children, do not necessarily need women or a wife to have that. So what was in a reality or was surreal in the beginning of the 20th century is not necessarily surreal now. And that's what's so interesting to combine Weill with that, is that Weill was realistic, and what was surreal is coming to be realistic. So that's another aspect of combining those two together.
Mm. And speaking of the happening things that are happening now that are directly relatable to the opera, you're incorporating some contemporary phenomena that are going on, such as the drought.
Right. Well, what we decided, our season this year with Opera Parallel focuses on how art can intersect with social issues. In June, we're going to do a darker opera, a very powerful, beautiful opera on human trafficking, actually. And we wanted to still have that theme, but not perhaps in such a more difficult presentation. So we decided that we would take the idea of what would happen if we had so many babies in one day, and the idea that we are actually, in fact, nowadays, perhaps this world is overpopulated, and what is difficult with overpopulation, and we lose our natural resources. And what's the best natural resource, or most important probably, is one of them is water. So that was a part of departure for the concept of how we're going to create this larger story, which will combine both of these opera into one big story. And basically the idea is that in Mahagoni, when they were looking for utopia, utopia becomes looking for water. So it's a very, very interesting, very fun concept.
Well, let's hear just an excerpt of some of the music. Set up one of the arias for us, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay, so maybe we'll hear the this is the beginning of the second act, and the husband tells us that he's doing 40,000, 41 babies in one day. And the babies appear, actually, in the... And what's very interesting in our production is we have also included the girls' chorus. So there'll be a very interesting way of staging this one little moment. But the husband is actually just stating that he is that he's making all these babies, and the babies appear on stage. And you'll hear in that little excerpt also the popular side of the music hall kind of atmosphere that Poulenc creates for that.
Ah, c'est fou from Les Mamelles de Tiresias.
Ah, c'est fou, les joies de la paternité. 40,049 enfants à la seule jour.
40,000 and assez fou, the birthing of some 40,000 children, a few of which will be represented by the San Francisco Girls Chorus on
and
this
more.
Production.
The other chorus, too.
Oh, great.
There are
great.
Two choruses,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a very inspired use of the girls' chorus. I understand there's some fascinating staging that's going to be happening.
Yes.
But tell us how the SS Méandre II came into your life.
The what?
The boat.
Oh, my God. The boat, the famous boat. Well, Brian always has original ideas. For those who have come to see our productions, he always has an element that create that is the starting point. And he thought, well, we're going to be in a drought. It's going to be no water. How about a boat on wheels going through dry land, which would need to... And then he was also trying to incorporate both operas. And the way that he's incorporating the opera, the Poulenc, is that the people on the boat are in the style of the medieval traveling theater troupes. The boat is actually their traveling theater that opens and becomes a theater when they arrive somewhere. So he thought, rather than just a theater, it'd be a boat, and so it would have different meaning. But to find the sizable boat that you can then transform into making it into a medieval theater that opens, and all the ideas he had was quite complicated. But so they went on a search. Though he had a whole team of people, that artistic team and others, looking for a boat for many months. And at first we drew designs of how we could build it, but realized that it would be best if we could probably find an original boat and then transform it. And probably last summer, around July, we finally got a phone call from David Dunning, who is our set designer, and he had seen a boat that was abandoned in the Santa Cruz Mountain. And so Brian readily drove down to the mountains and looked at it with him, and it took another month to find the owner of that boat, and he sold it to us for a minimal price, and we moved that boat into the shop and transformed that original boat into a huge piece that is the major piece of the production.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Tell us a little bit about the singers that are involved in this production.
So we have, I think, an amazing cast of singers. They're all young and very, very dedicated to trying out new things, and all very beautifully fitted for their role. And what's interesting is that they are, most of them, except for one character, travel from one opera to the other, so they have to be able to sing Weill and Poulenc. So we had to identify a voice that could do both colors, because the color of Weill is a little, is quite different from the color of Poulenc.
And will they be singing in English or French or German or a combination?
So they will be singing the operas in their original languages. So the Weill is mostly in German with two pieces in English, the two very well-known songs that I think people know, and in English. And then the Poulenc is in French.
And those two songs are?
The two songs, we have the Benares song, that, and then the Whiskey Bar song that I think.
Indeed. Speaking of which, we don't have your fine cast singing this, but we do have the incomparable Marianne Faithfull singing part of Alabama Song. So let's have a listen to that, and we'll talk more about it. We'll get back, circle back to Poulenc.
Sounds good.
Show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why. Oh, don't ask why. For we must find the next whiskey bar. For if we don't find the next whiskey bar, I tell you we must die. I tell you we must die. I tell you, I tell you, I tell you we must die. Alabama, we now must say goodbye. We've lost our good old mama and must have whiskey, or you know why. Oh, moon of Alabama, we now must say goodbye.
The wonderful wrecked voice of Marianne Faithfull, which works so well for Kurt Weill.
It really does. It would not necessarily work over a full orchestra in a big hall, but how she does it on a recording is fantastic.
So that song, although it's not sung quite that way, will be part of this production.
Right. Well, this is the same. The spirit of the song remains, even if it's sung differently, and she has the great spirit for it.
Mm-hmm. We've got time for just this final aria. Mm-hmm. Tell us what's happening in the scene.
That's the end, and basically what's interesting is at the end of the Poulenc before we... And you know, one thing that is interesting in the way we're doing this is Weill starts... We do Weill completely, then we do Poulenc as a play inside a play, and then we return to a very short retrograde version of the Weill. Sort of we frame the Poulenc with the Weill in both ends. So that's right before they finish. They're going to close the boat, the theater, and move on to their... their Weill journey. And the wife, Tiresias, his wife, takes her costume off and says to her husband, "Don't you recognize me? I am your wife." And they finish the play by saying that we need to love each other and make babies.
Thanks for being with us, Nicole. I wish you a fantastic production. Information at operaparallel.org.
Thank you.
Et bien le pot, on est le pot.
Final scene of Les Mamelles de Tiresias, combined with Mahogany Songspiel at the Yerba Buena Center under the direction of Nicole Paimont. I should give a little shout-out as well to K.T. Nelson, who's the choreographer, working with the great creative team that also includes Brian Stauffenbiel. Information and tickets for this fantastic performance of Opera Parallel at ybca.org. Peter Robinson up next. Stay with us here on Open Air.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Fremde, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleibe, reste, stay. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. Im Cabaret, au Cabaret du Cabaret.
Cabaret of a different sort now with Peter Robinson. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to see you. And I'm pleased to announce that Cabaret is both living and thriving here in the Bay Area. And in case you think Cabaret is just for the old folks like myself who remember Cole Porter and Noel Coward, let me announce that at the Venetian Room this weekend, that's the 27th, there is the high school vocal competition, which is put on by the Bay Area Cabaret Society. It's an annual event, and it involves the Young Actors Theatre Camp. It's now in its third year, and there are judges from the Idol, that's the musical director, Michael Orland, and people who know the X Factor, the finalist, Jason Brock. So Cabaret really extends to a wide range of audiences. And as I say, this particular one is geared at high school students who are the best singers, and this is their chance to come out and shine. And that's the Venetian Room. You can get more information on their website, which is bayareacabaret.org. And it is an event which starts at 3 o'clock this coming Sunday. Now, by contrast, for people who recognize the what I call the traditional cabaret, which is a very intimate style of presentation and performance, the audience and the performer are usually only feet apart. They're very close. Seldom does it involve an orchestra. It's usually a pianist and a performer. And one of my favorite places to go is the Hotel Rex, which is on Sutter Street. And last week, opening their recent season, is Billy Philadelphia and his wife Meg. This was just a wonderful performance. Lasts a little over an hour, about an hour and a half. And you will hear some of your favorites, some of the great classics. And there is this element of storytelling to cabaret, how people's lives intermingle with the songs they sing. Now, I said it's thriving around the city, and another place is the Zingari Ristorante Jazz Lounge, which is in the Donatella Hotel down on Post Street. Marilyn Cooney will be performing there, both at the end of this month and again in May. It's another intimate setting, so there's plenty of opportunities, if you have the voice for it, to shout out and ask for your song to be sung.
Well, another place you can go to do your own shouting out and participate in some live piano bar cabaret is, of course, Martuni's down on Market Street, a great
location. Martuni's the art, and you give them the sheet, you tell them what key, and then you keep your fingers crossed that they play the piano at the right speed. You practice the song after that, as they say, God help you. Alfred Steakhouse, not only steak and dinner there, but in the later evening on the first Monday of every month, they have a supper club with cabaret there. So those are two or three of the ventures.
I'd be very concerned as a cabaret artist in a room that has a bunch of steak knives nearby. I have to be top of my game on that stage.
That's right. A knife in your throat could be the end of the song, and that's how it goes. Now, by way of contrast, I've also been to the movies this week, and I want to say a brief word about the new Colin Firth movie. It's called The Railway Man. This is an extraordinary film in many ways. It's reviving an old story about the relationship between the prisoner and the torturer. It's set in World War II. Nicole Kidman plays the wife of a soldier. A soldier is played by Colin Firth, who returns after having done 4 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp at the end of World War II after the fall of Singapore. In fact, it's the same railway, that famous Burma Death Railway, which was used in the bridge over the River Kwai. So there are these scenes, and they are some of the more horrific scenes. The Japanese version in World War II of waterboarding is demonstrated. I think it's a film that Dick Cheney definitely ought to see if you want to see that this is definitely torture and not somebody being held underwater for a period of time. It's also a powerful love story, and it's a story which not many critics have written about. It's about healing, because Nicole Kidman was, in the role of the wife, a nurse. The post-traumatic stress disorder which he's suffering from is part of the healing. And then the film ends with these moments of reconciliation when he finally meets his torturer many years after the war. And in real life, they do become friends. In fact, it's based on the book which Eric Lomax, that's the British soldier, wrote in 1995. And both the torturer and the recovered torturer and the prisoner, they died just a couple of years ago. So an interesting film, great acting, a little cinematic, but it is a theme of reconciliation and forgiveness, and I think appropriate for today when we discover issues of torture.
The film is The Railway Man, featuring Nicole Kidman, Stellan Skarsgård, and Colin Firth, among others. Thank you, Peter.
And I'd finally like to pay just a brief tribute to Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the 1982 Nobel Prize winner for literature. He died last week at the age of 87, and of course is best known for his book, the book on solitude. But I think I wanted to say, in a slightly different context, how two of his other books, Love in the Time of Cholera particularly, which was dedicated to Mercedes, that is his wife, who his widow, who he married in 1958, and also to touch on A Chronicle of a Death Foretold. Both these would be turned into movies. They did not work. They were made essentially from an American, North American point of view, and that takes me into the realm of magic realism, because I think these work in print. They take you into the whole fantastic, and sometimes the directness of a screen didn't always work. Now, Marquez essentially believed in telling the truth, and he felt as a journalist, particularly writing in South America, that the restrictions imposed upon him meant he couldn't always get the story out. And that, of course, is why he felt that fiction, or the narrative form in novel form, would be the way that he set out to express what was really going on. He's been a great gift to literature throughout the world, and certainly anyone who grew up in the 60s and remembered his early works were really introduced to a new aspect of South American literature, which I think is many ways been both page-turning and news-breaking just because of the style that he wrote. Again, go back to him, read the pages again, and we regret and will miss future writings by him. That's Garcia Marquez, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who died last week.
Thank you for that remembrance, Peter, and thank you, as always, for your contributions to Open Air.
Good to be here, David.
Open Air is produced by myself and Niels Swinkels. Shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. You can listen to them anytime. You can also send an email to david@kalw.org if you've got a segment suggestion or something you'd like to see featured that's happening here on the Bay Area art scene. david@kalw.org. BBC News is next here on Local Public Radio, KALW. Thanks for listening.